All right, come on in, guys. Scoot on up. Let's fill in these front areas. Is there a way to turn off these from back there? Can y'all turn off these? Because I literally can only see like the front row. Oh, wow. I was going to need sunscreen. Come on in, guys. We're good. Yes, sir. Thanks, Chris. We'll see how many. Somebody let them know we're starting. Let the guys outside know we're starting just in case they want to come in. It takes a certain amount of courage to come in for a sex talk. Apparently, some of the men at the conference didn't have enough courage to. They know they need it. But you have a certain amount of confidence in your own penis size in order to be at a talk on sex. That's exactly right. That's right. They're going to listen to it on their own in their car when it's just them. I'm still getting some metallic stuff, which it may be because these are set like as if there's going to be a room full of people and it's just us. All right, so I want to introduce myself to you a little bit. I was the Pine Cove chaplain up until about 7 years ago, and then they retired that job title after I left, apparently deciding that it was something that could not be replaced, so, or didn't need to. One of the two was decided, and which was a fantastic time, and may even be that some of you have been coming longer than that, and so I've done breakout sessions most years, I think, for probably the last 14 years at the men's conference. And when I left Pine Cove, I wasn't super excited about it, but it was the right thing for me. And I started doing full-time private practice counseling again. I'm a licensed counselor. And I wasn't sure why God would put me back into that, because for me, that's a little bit isolating. I love doing it, but it's a little isolating, and you get stuck, and it's not a very good team situation. And my passion is doing ministry with my friends. And so about 4 years ago, I had the opportunity to, even though the practice was exploding here in Tyler, and I was booked for months in advance, I had the opportunity to take on the pastorate of a church. And so the First Baptist South Campus here in Tyler hired me to be their pastor at that campus, the campus pastor there. And but I kept the counseling center open, which is now Aletheia Family Counseling Center. Now I have 9 therapists who work there, and so but that's my part-time job. I only do that one day a week on Thursdays. And you can be praying for me, because now we're now making that transition into a new building. We're going to buy rather than lease. And you guys, some of you guys who run businesses know how much fun that process can be. Even if it's a good thing, it's always stressful. So, and that, of course, is I'm supposed to try to pull that off in one day a week, that kind of thing in one day a week. And my full-time job is at the church, where I've gotten to steal staff from Pine Cove for the last 4 years and to bring them on as pastors at the church. And so it's phenomenal opportunity, and if you thought that was funny, I literally all but one staff member I have hired since I left has at least previous experience at Pine Cove. It's just you talk about an opportunity to build a team, knowing that they've had certain types of training, had certain types of discipleship, certain types of leadership. That's money. So what I'm going to talk about today, I really feel like one of the reasons maybe that God had me go back in a full-time private practice for 2 or 3 years was what I'm going to share with you today. I feel like most Christian marriages, they're awful. They really are just terrible. And I really do think probably close to 80, 90% of Christian marriages are failures in the church. They may stay together. They may pay taxes together. They may pay rent or mortgage together, live under the same roof. But most of them are just awful. There's very little sense of purpose, mission, calling. What are these all about? And I'm a big fan of believing, and I will encourage you. I don't get paid for telling you to go to my website. I mean, it boosts my ego like everybody else, but it does. I don't get paid for it. At chrismlegg.com, which there is a phalanx page for men only. There's something for my counseling center page. But I would encourage you. What I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to give you the about hour-long version of what is a 2 or 3 hour long. I do romance. When I do the romance meet conferences here at Pine Cove or others, I do the 2 or 3 hour version for co-ed teams. And Man, stop distracting me. I play soccer in this room with Bird every Tuesday night, so I can make fun of him. I live right down there, which made a lot more sense when I worked here. I could draw my house on that little map back there with all the camps. So I really feel like one of the reasons that Christian marriages are so bad, that they don't have that, is often because as men, we aren't leading our families well, which is what Craig is talking about in there. And my guess is there'll be a big group of there because they're recognizing that. I also think part of why men aren't inspired to lead well in their families is because there's this generalized sense of this isn't the way it's supposed to be. And so we experience our marriages through this lens of feeling like somewhere between constant and consistent disappointment. And that's not super inspiring. And so it's like it kind of sucks the life out of us. And one of the things that's so amazing is one of the things I believe God intended was for marriage to be the hotbed, obviously, for expressing sexual passion and naked and unashamed. The original way that Adam and Eve in the garden, and I think that garden creates a good picture for what God intended. And so it's not that way. And so being a theologian, a pastor, I'm going to explain some of the questions that came up. But as a therapist, I want to be giving you some very hands-on techniques, no pun intended, for how to make this how to bring some life back to this. And part of it is going to be explaining what we're going to talk about today to your wife. The reason I'm sending you to my website is because the two-hour version of this talk is on my website. So you can go to my website and type in sex talks, and if your porn filter will let you do that, then you can then go to the page, and it's me teaching this at my church, the long version, co-ed version, and then you can listen to it with your wife at no charge. So I think this is important, and if you connect with this today, here's what's wild. Most of what I'm going to say today, you intuitively already know to be true. But it's something that either you thought you were the only person who thought and felt this way, or like most men, you don't have enough sophistication in regards to communicating emotionally in order to really put a label with it. None of us are trained to do that. If you go back on your life and ask yourself, how much training you got to be in the job you're in now, probably it was somewhere between some and significant. If you ask yourself how much training you got to be married, it's going to be somewhere between none and a lot of bad information. So like negative, you came in with a negative training score when you started marriage. And parenting is just as bad. So here's instead, I want to give you the picture. This is what I think is situated. Let me show you one of the Bible passages that made me start asking myself, wait, what if this isn't just me who thinks this way? And so then finding the research of Shanti Feldon, who did actual research before she published her book on marriage, which is a novel concept in Christianity. No one does that. They just publish what they think, and then people began to accept it as truth, and we end up with these statements. In fact, some of the things that we have been taught, it turns out, are diametrically opposed to what the research shows. And when I do premarital counseling, I have a very intense, like 75-question sexual attitude survey that I give the newlywed couple, or the soon-to-be newlywed couple, and they make certain mistakes on that test that is predictable as the sun coming up in the morning, gender-wise, because they have been so trained to think certain ways. In fact, let me give you an example. How many of you have been in church like since at least being a teenager? Okay, so wow. So most of you how many of you experienced youth camp as a kid? How many of them did they talk about sex on probably Wednesday night was sex ever talked about at youth camp? Okay, so the way sex was taught to me at youth camp was this. This is the line I remember really, really well. Girls, beware of the guys. That was the theme statement. Girls, beware of the guys, because guys will play at love, which they don't understand, in order to get sex, which is what they really want. And girls, you will play at sex, which you don't understand, in order to get love, which is what you really want. Anybody else have a message, anything like that, at some point in your... Okay, so now stop and ask yourself, can you imagine why your Christian wife doubts your motives? If she's been taught that at church camp, all of her life, some version of that. Sadly, sometimes they even go to a women's conference and they get told things, this is a direct quote, things like, hey ladies, sometimes you just got to take one for the team. Can you imagine anything less respectful? Now, some of you may be in a situation in your marriage, you're like, Yeah, I'd be okay with that at this point. Like, anything would be fine. But that mindset of like, okay, that's what this is really about, is sex is really about a woman doing something that she doesn't want to do because she has to, because, and I'm going to explain some of that. So here's the story that began, one of the stories that began to really cause me to scratch my head. One of the funny things about teaching the Bible is that most of us know nothing about the Bible, and then we also know very little about history. And so when you start putting them together, it becomes fascinating, especially for men. Men really love when you put the historical context of something together. So check this out. There's a woman named Esther who is picked up off the street, essentially kidnapped, to be a part of a man's harem. And the man, his name is probably Xerxes. The Hebrews had different names for these Persian kings, and so, but we're pretty sure this was Xerxes. Xerxes, kind of interesting dude, and if you've seen the movie 300, you still don't know anything about Xerxes. It's a awful, and you know nothing else about that historical period except that there were people, and you know their names they went by. It was a ridiculous movie. So the but what you had a presentation with Xerxes is like a 17-foot-tall man with gold hanging all off his body and that kind of stuff. That is potentially how Xerxes saw himself. Xerxes was God on earth, probably in the top five most powerful men to ever live within their own time in all of human history. Xerxes is the one, just to give you context for who you're dealing with here. So if you've ever seen a movie or heard the story of Esther told in any way that sounds romantic, forget it. There's nothing romantic about this story. Xerxes was picking up virgins, all having his agents pick up virgins off the street who their king might find interesting. And then the women went through a year of training with a horde of eunuchs in order to prepare them for their one night with Xerxes. And then they got one night with him. And that was their big moment. Now, yes, this was probably a step up for them from the awful poverty that people lived in the Persian kingdom to now at least have enough to eat and drink and a place to stay. And the price was you had to pay one night with the king. So here you have Xerxes with hundreds, maybe thousands of these different wives and concubines, and maybe tens of thousands of them. But to understand who this is the guy whose dad got insulted by the Greeks. And the reason his dad was insulted by the Greeks was because he invaded Greece and the Greeks stopped him. And that was a huge insult to Darius. And so Darius was really upset about this, but died before he could put together another army to go really teach the Greeks a lesson. So his son Xerxes mounted what may have been the largest marching army in the history of mankind, somewhere in the area of 1 to 2 million men. This is 500 years before Christ. 1 to 200 million men, marches them from the Persian Empire, made up of people from all over the world, the best and finest soldiers from all over the world, and marches them down to Greece. And the Greeks have very little warning, and they're a tiny little country, and so they're only able to mount an immediate defense of about 5,000 Greeks, not 300, like you were taught, 5,000. There were allegedly 300 Spartans, but about 5,000 other Greeks. And the Spartans certainly led that, and they stopped them at a narrow pass, a place called Thermopylae, which means gates of fire. It was a hot springs like Arkansas. So they stopped them there. And because these were professional soldiers who actually had tactics, had cutting-edge weaponry, the greatest training, all that kind of stuff, they held them for 7 days until the Persians got around behind them. Now, that's what you know about it. What you probably don't know is on the way to Greece, trying to cross the Hellespont River, he built these huge barges with these huge bridges and crossed his massive army. And at one point, a storm hit, wiped out all of his bridges and barges, and killed thousands and thousands of his men who were trying to cross the river. Xerxes then has the Hellespont River beaten. I mean, literally lines the shores with men with whips and clubs. And he declares a verdict against the Hellespont River that it has tried to defy God on earth, Xerxes. And so they beat the river, certain number of lashes, as was designed by him. Then they threw in handcuffs and chains to hold it in place to teach it its lesson. Then he re-put out bridges and barges. And this apparently it worked, because this time he was able to cross with no further incident. This is a guy who's a few bricks short of a load, and yet is probably a sociopath, and has been raised to be so his entire life. That is who Esther is getting her one night with. So maybe that'll allow you to reinterpret that story next time you see it, so that we don't, as most people do, set it in about 1800s and with a sweet little romantic story where she gets to be crowned sitting next to Xerxes on the throne. That didn't happen. So she gets her one night with the king, and apparently was so much fun to hang out with that he declares her a queen the next day probably means she gets her, like, her own room or something like that, and some servants, because there were probably lots of queens. And then does not engage with her in any shape, form, or fashion for a month. In fact, probably had new women each night for that month. A month later, she comes to him and begs an audience with him, and he allows it, and because he vaguely remembers he has some positive feelings about this person. And so he says, "What do you want?" And she says, "I want to have a banquet with you." I'm getting somewhere. "So I want to have a banquet with you." So we have a seductive, sweet, flirtatious banquet. It's probably what we should imagine. Esther doing her best. Haman is there, which we won't go into that part of the story. Haman is there, and the king is there, and the three of them and all their servants. And she puts on what you have to assume is probably a very flirtatious, maybe even seductive banquet for the king. At the end of this seductive banquet with God on earth, who owns her like property, he says, "This has been so fun, I'll give you anything you want." And does anybody remember what she says, what she asks for? Another banquet. "Come back tomorrow night." Now, what we have been told and what all of the women in our lives believe is that all men want is sex. So we've been taught. We've been taught it and we've come to believe it. They've been taught it and they've come to believe it. So if that's the truth, what happens then? So beautiful, exotic, well-trained slave girl Esther says, "Come back tomorrow night." And Xerxes says what? If all men wanted sex, what does Xerxes say? Xerxes says, "No. I have different plans for how this evening is going to end. We're going to have sex right now. None of this tomorrow night crap. We're going to do it now. Because that's all the men care about." He has nothing on the line. He has no risk whatsoever involved in this. He would say, "No, I'll tell you what, Haman, take a hike." But instead, Xerxes says, "Okay, I'll come back tomorrow night." Why? Here's what's wild. Most of you in the room totally identify with this. I did. Yeah, I'd leave and come back tomorrow night. Why? Because here's what you probably already know. What men really want is to be freely chosen by a woman who wants to be freely chosen by him. And sex is the most powerful way we know how to choose and be chosen. That's really what we want. That's why Xerxes would be intrigued by this. Maybe Xerxes never even experienced the potential that a woman might want to be with him. Not faking want to be with him, but maybe actually wants to be with him. Never crossed his mind to think about that before. He's not been raised to think that way. This is a moment. And the truth is that is the case for us. One of the things that caused me to think about this was years ago, a woman who had read a Christian book that talks about the needs that men and women have. And she came back and said, "Okay, so apparently he wants sex, an attractive wife, and domestic support. So what he really wants is a prostitute who cleans his house." And I thought, why don't I have a prostitute who cleans my house? Why don't any of us have prostitutes who clean our house? And don't give me a moral answer, "Well, because we're good Christian men." Because I don't know anybody who has prostitutes who clean their house. Hugh Hefner even marries those girls. Nobody does that. If they do, I've not heard of it. Nobody has prostitutes who clean their house. If that's what we really want, is sex, and attractive wife, and domestic support, then wouldn't we, as men who run the world, wouldn't we have prostitutes who cleaned our house? I mean, think how much easier that would be. How much less complicated? Cheaper? It'd be a darn sight cheaper, right? Why don't we do that then? Because it's not what we want. That's why. What we want is to be freely chosen by a woman who freely wants us. That's why prostitution, even though in movies and TV shows, guys talk about prostitution. You ever notice that? Like, guys will talk about being with a prostitute in a movie or TV show. No one really does that. As a therapist, I'll tell you, no one does that. Sometimes I can really push a man who's a sex addict to talk about that. But men will hide that. Why? Because they're ashamed of it. Even secular, lost, worldly men typically are ashamed of it. They're embarrassed of it. they can only go to strip clubs and mobs. Because we kind of have to comfort one another that it's okay that we're here. Because it's embarrassing to be involved in something like that. And we intuitively get that because we know we're accepting a counterfeit under those conditions. We know this is a counterfeit. This isn't what we really want. We really want the $5,000 Rolex, but we can only save $100 a month. And unfortunately for us, there's a guy on the side of the road hawking Rolexes for $100 a month, 100% of the time, isn't there? Whether it's through prostitution or most commonly now, pornography or things like that. There's always somebody selling you a fake Rolex for $100. We all experience it 5,000 times a day. And it becomes a huge temptation for us to walk away from giving away our $100 for something that's going to turn our arm green. And we go, no, this isn't what I really want. And you know it's not what you really want, and I know it's not what I really want. That doesn't mean it's not tempting, and it doesn't mean the pornography industry doesn't spend billions learning how to tempt us well. And they do, billions and billions. Largest, maybe the largest industry in the world. Do you know that? Maybe. I don't know the recent numbers. I remember in 2006, the pornography industry represented more income and outflow of cash than the entire sports industry combined. NFL, NBA, baseball, hockey, soccer combined. And let me be honest with you. My first thought was, I thought it was free. With this much free pornography, that much money is still exchanging hands? Like, that's nuts. It's one of the number one things we deal with in the church, with pastors, is accepting that counterfeit. None of us think it's real, but we're willing to accept it as real for a few seconds. It turns out, when you work in a big city, I was a counselor in Dallas for a while. When you work in a big city, people only know people who are in their same career. In a city like Tyler, people know everybody. But in a place like Dallas, people only know people in the same career. So you help them in therapy, and they start sending their friends, and all their friends are in the same line of work as they are. So there was a fireman who came in and was having some really tough PTSD stuff going on, and I helped him work through that. And for the next year, a third or to a quarter of my clients were firemen and EMTs. I mean, that was like, who was, and then they would send their friends, and they would send their friends, and it was, and in Dallas, some of you may know this, in Dallas, Fort Worth, especially Fort Worth, I think, the stripping industry is extremely powerful. It's a big industry in Fort Worth. And so there was a lady who's a stripper who I managed to help through some issues in her life, and she started sending her friends who were all strippers, male and female. So about a third to a fifth of my clients for about a year were strippers, male and female. I learned a whole lot about the sex industry during that year, more than I needed to know. One of the questions that struck me at some point was this question: which stripper makes the most money? So if you ask normal people that question, which stripper do you think makes the most money in a given strip joint? We will give answers that have to do with athleticism or body appearance or that kind of stuff. That's what normal people answer. No stripper answered that way. Not one. And since then, I've had the opportunity to talk to some people that are involved in ministries in regards to saving people from the sex industry. And they will tell you, oh yeah, they all know that's not the right answer. The right answer is the woman who, while on stage, can make the most men think that the only reason she's there tonight is for him. That's the one who makes the most money. You talk about a jacked up, broken version. And by the way, they hate men. They talk about a jacked up, broken version of sex. And yet, even then, guys, what is it that we're looking for? A woman who might want us and who might be wanted by us. A woman who might freely want us. Now, I don't know that we ever, except for in moments of extreme delusion, would we actually ever believe that she wants us. But we could fool ourselves into thinking it for a few minutes. So what is it we really want? So let me tell you how this plays out in most of our marriages. And I think why sex, which obviously God intended to be a powerful form of strength in our marriage, for most of our marriages has become exactly the opposite, is this. So imagine a newlywed couple, and for them sex is a novelty. Everything I'm going to describe gets only more complicated and worse if they are sexually experienced, which is one of the reasons why premarital sex is a bad idea, because it makes all of these complications worse, 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 magnified worse. But for the sake of our conversation, we're going to say, let's assume that they are both sexually inexperienced, and then they get married. For them, sex is a novelty. So it's a new toy, and it's very special to both of them, and they have sex, and they're both happy about it, and they don't understand anything about the dynamics of it at this point, the complications of it, and I'll explain why in a second. But they, so they engage in sex, and it's a very positive emotional experience for both of them. Unless there's something broken in there, obviously, unless there's abuse or something like that. So, so let's say he goes away one weekend. They've been married 6-8 months. He goes away for a weekend and comes home. And she, who is still learning to wield this new power that she has in his life, which is a healthy thing, by the way. That's not bad. No, I've not heard any men complain about the thought of his young wife realizing how powerful her sexuality is with her husband and using that in regards to how they relate to one another. Like, this is really cool. So she spreads rose petals to the bed, and she seduces him when he comes home from his little trip with some, you know, nighty type thing or whatever, and she seduces him. What are the emotions? This is tough. What are the emotions that he feels in that at that time? Wanted? That he's the only man on earth? What else? Accepted? Surprised? Loved? Excited and aroused? Sure. Anything else? Yeah, confusion because he has no training. Special. There's a good one. You know, it's funny is when I do this in a co-ed setting, most wives are not used to their husband speaking in any way to be vaguely poetic. And so when I do this in a quiz and I ask the men, how does that feel? And guys start tossing out words like this, special. One of the ones I did recently, a guy in the room said, like, everything is right with the world. And what's funny is as guys are throwing out these answers, I can watch the women's faces as they're going like, and I'll make a joke and go, now, ladies, right now, here's what you're thinking. We are still just talking about sex, right? I'm going to explain why that happens. So, like, you're the only guy in the world. I'll be using that one from now on, by the way. That's new. A word that often comes up is home. A guy will throw out the word, I feel like I'm where I belong. I'm home. I feel more welcome than I've ever been in my life. This is where I belong. Like I'm the only guy in the world. Like everything is right with the world. Now listen, notice, it's not about the orgasm. That's fun and that's fine. It is about the emotional power that what you just described. When else do you feel that way? One of the mistakes that people make all the time in that premarital sex test, one of the questions is, men can have a totally satisfying sex life without having a good relationship with his sexual partner or without even knowing her. And women always agree with that statement because they've been taught that for men, sex is a physical act, not an emotional act. Let me tell you how much research there is to back that. None. Christian sexual writers have been writing that in their books for decades with no basis of that at all. Shanti Feldon starts doing research and doing studies and asks the question, if you knew your wife was, not even what I just described, this question, if you knew your wife was available to have sex anytime you wanted, but wasn't into it and really interested, would you be satisfied with your sex life? Nobody answers yes to that. Why not? Is that totally fly in the face of what we've been taught? I mean, men, it's a physical act. It doesn't make any difference. She can read a book for all I care, right? No one feels that way. No one reports that. People get a place in their marriage where they're desperate enough to have even the tiniest bit of connection sexually where they will accept that. That's not what we would choose. No man goes, oh, that's fine. Well, that's not true. Not no man. There's a small percentage. But they represent probably the narcissists and the sociopaths and the abusive freaks. It's incredibly small. Here's what's wild. You knew that. You may not know how to put the words to it, but you knew that. And so you watch TV shows and read stuff like that claims that, and you've always thought, I guess I'm the freak. No, it turns out no one thinks that way. At least men don't. In fact, here's what's wild. We as men, we integrate sexuality into our identity. We don't divide out our sexuality from our identity at all. Very few of us do. Abuse in childhood can cause a breach between a man's identity and sexuality, but very few other things can. And even then, it's often not really far. And sometimes even abuse doesn't cause that. The men don't divide out their identity from their sexuality. You've never probably wondered, if your wife started to come on to you, it never crossed your mind to think, well, does she want me or does she just want sex? Right? It's not that you thought that and dismissed it. It's that your brain's never gone there because you integrate them just like I do. Well, of course she wants me. How do I know? Because she wants sex with me. What more evidence would I need that this person wants me? Because that's me. That's me she's having sex with. And by the way, here's what's wild. It's her we're having sex with. We do that naturally. We integrate that fairly naturally. When you're pursuing your wife sexually, in your mind, most of you are pursuing your wife. You're not pursuing sex. You're pursuing your wife. This is the most powerful way to have her and be had by her. When you hear those type of emotional words, and then I tell wives like, now you get why we want to engage sexually. Is there a testosterone drive aspect to it? Of course there is. But let me just tell you, it is by far the least important part of the entire process. What matters is someone wants me. I'm like the only guy in the world. Everything is right in the world. I feel special. I feel loved. I feel accepted. I feel home. Who wouldn't want that again? What kind of an idiot would you have to be to go like, and that's not that important to me. Take it or leave it. That's why that's really uncommon for men. We integrate it into our identity. And let me tell you where we create so much trauma in our marriages. We think our wives do too, and they don't. It's extremely rare for wives, for women to integrate sexuality into their identity. Their sexuality is divided out from their identity. I don't know if it's a result of the fall. I don't know if that's a consequence of the fact that 1 in 4 of them get sexually assaulted by the time they're 20. I don't know what causes that, but almost every woman I've ever worked with in therapy, and the majority have been women because as men, we're not secure enough to go get counseling even when we need it. Incidentally, I'll give you, here's the rule for knowing when you need counseling. If anyone in your life thinks you need counseling, you need counseling. Anyone in your life thinks you do. Because you're not going to think you do. I mean, think of it as like putting on the brakes. You're blindfolded, driving around the Grand Canyon, and you have a family of people in the car with you. If one of them says, put on the brakes, as men, we will typically go, I've got this. This is how you know. Somebody says, well, I think we need to talk to somebody. What you should be doing is that afternoon have someone scheduled. I'm not saying that because financial income for me, I'm trying to save you lawyer fees. So when you say, we don't know to have these conversations. We don't know how to have these conversations. We don't know how to talk about this. So here's what happens. 6 months go by. And by the way, it's awesome. And by the way, she's totally happy about it too. It was awesome. She loves that engagement, especially when she's got plenty of emotional energy lying around. Now, so she says, so he goes away again. This time, she doesn't think about sex the whole time she's gone. He's gone. It never crosses her mind. Her identity is divided out from her sexuality. By the way, when your identity is integrated with something, you need a reason not to do it. You hear that? So if your identity is integrated with something, you need a reason not to do it. If your identity is not integrated into something, you need a reason to do it. So the example I use often in my marriage is buying baby clothes. Okay? My wife, is her identity as a mom is integrated into her identity. This is integrated into who she is. She needs a reason to not do mom stuff. For example, to nest. When she goes to Target, every single item, she has to have a reason to not purchase it. If she doesn't have a reason to not purchase it, then she does. Because she doesn't need a reason to purchase it. It's integrated into her identity. It requires no emotional energy for her. This is where we get confused. It said it requires no emotional energy for her to do that. At the end of an exhausting day, we have 5 kids. At the end of an exhausting day, she's totally at zero. She has no energy left. And one of her friends calls and says, hey, Kelly's got a baby shower tomorrow. Do you want to go buy baby clothes with me? I mean, she's at zero. She's got nothing. She's out the door. Going to buy baby clothes requires no emotional investment, like no emotional energy. She doesn't have to invest any energy. It requires zero, and it's worth 40 points. She invests nothing and comes back with 40 points more of emotional energy. She left feeling bad. She comes back feeling better. And so being a good husband who wants my wife to have 40 points of emotional energy, I'm like, go, go, go. Understand that's what sex is like for us. It's integrating our identity. See the investment difference? If my wife, so let's imagine it's an exhausting day. I have an awful day. I'm down to zero or negative 10. And one of my guy friends calls me and says, hey, I've got a baby shower tomorrow. You want to go buy baby clothes? What am I going to say? No. It costs 20 points for me to go to Target. And every minute I'm there is another 2 points. It costs points for me to be there. It costs points for me to go. Now, if I go with a good friend and we hang out and it's fun, that might be worth 40 points. I mean, going and hanging out with a friend is always worth emotional energy points. But if I don't have it, so if I said right now, guys, I have $40,000. I will hand it to you if you will bring me $10,000 in cash by the time I get to 10. One, two, three. No one's coming. Why not? None of you have $10,000 in cash, right? Okay, I'll make it $100,000. $1 million. Am I helping? No. You still don't have $10,000. You still have the initial investment. And no amount of me trying to motivate you is going to give you that initial investment. It's still not there. It's gone. You just don't have it. That's what your wife means when you say, hey, you want to mess around later? And she goes, I'd love to have sex. I just can't. And you go, wait, what? Are you speaking Martian? It's free. Burns calories. Doesn't take that long. What's the negative here? I mean, what's wrong with this? It's all positives and no negatives. The problem is it's not integrated into her identity, so it requires some points for her to engage. 20 points to initiate. 10 points to just engage. At the end of the day, so do you see why early on in marriage you have sex all the time? Is because you've got emotional energy laying around on the floor at the end of the day. No one's demanding anything of you when you're early to mid-20s. No one cares what you do or don't do. And so you start the day with 100 points. You end the day with 60. You want to have sex? Sure. Cost 20 points. I'll still have 40 more left over. And what I hear from the wives all the time is, I never regret that we had sex. It's always fun. What's interesting is you hear that from men constantly. Like, oh, that's awesome. I love having sex with my husband. It's great. Well, then why don't you have sex tonight? What she's doing immediately is allocating those 10 to 20 points from the rest of her day. Where am I going to get those 10 to 20 points? I teach this to MOPS, mothers of preschoolers, all the time. They're the perfect age to teach this stuff to. Because they're like, they know something's wrong too. They don't know what. Well, what's wrong is they have these little emotional vampires running around their ankles constantly. Children are vampires. They suck the emotional energy out of you, and they don't give you hardly any back. And they're never done sucking that out of you. Any of you experienced that? That moment when your kid goes, no, I'm good. You ever had that 7-year-old? No, I couldn't think of anything else we could do together, Dad. No. He's got another, oh, let's look at these Legos. Let's go play this. Let's go do that. Let's go do, you're the one constantly going like, I know I'm a bad dad for saying this, but no. No, I can't go play Legos with you right now. No, I can't. Well, please? No. I mean, what? They're emotional vampire, and they're doing that to your wife too. And so here's what's wild. At the end of the day, you've got no emotional points. She's got no emotional points. You're saying, I can invest 0 points and get 40 back. And you think she can too. But the truth is, she has to invest 20 in order to get those 40 back. And she's already at zero or minus 20. If she goes into debt, she may start resenting that. Especially if this happens. He goes away. She didn't think about sex the whole time. Back to our story. He comes home and she's in head-to-toe flannels and sound asleep. No rose petals. He comes home and he's going, now, is he hoping for that same type of welcome again? Well, yeah, he'd be a moron. He'd be a delusional idiot. Not to. What type of, remember what we described? Loved, wanted, special, only man in the world. Who wouldn't want a repeat of that? I have to tell its wives, stop resenting the fact that your husband wants to experience those emotions. That's what we're looking for, is that type of emotional moment. By the way, on that premarital sex test, that the wives all say, yeah, the girls all say, yeah, men can have disinterested sex and have sex with guys, women who they don't care about, and they don't have to have the emotional connection. The women always put yes on that, because as I've been trained to say, 100% of the males I've married and done premarital counseling with have said no. 100%. I've never had a guy say, yeah, I can do that. Because we know it's not true. And in an individual moment, might that be the case? Potentially. But can he have a happy sex life? Absolutely not. Even with the prostitute, even with the pornography, even with the stripper, he's looking for an emotional connection. It's one of the freakiest things about rapists and abusers. What we know they're looking for is an emotional connection. They have picked a broken, fallen, evil, sinful way to seek that. But, and I'm not in any way justifying any of that, obviously. However, even under those broken versions of sexuality, that's still what men are looking for. So, he comes home, she's in bed. Now, here's what you need to hear from the wife. I ask, are you happy that he's home? And the wives will say, oh my gosh, I'm so happy he's home. Have you missed him? I've missed him terribly. How much of him do you feel like you have now when he climbs in bed next to you and you just roll over and give him a kiss and roll back over in your head-to-toe flannels? Go back to sleep. And they're like, 100%, we got him all the way. And ask men, are you all the way home yet? And they go, no. Because, see, sexuality is integrated into our identity. Whereas it would be similar for most wives, not all wives, most wives it would be similar to if you just brushed past your children after being gone from a trip and totally ignored them and then went up to her, and she'd be like, aren't you going to say hi to the kids? You're not totally home until you've engaged with the kids for her. Because that's integrating her identity. In the same way, so here's what happens. Early on in marriage, he's not emotionally sophisticated. Very few of us are. We're not trained on how to talk about this type of stuff. So he starts wondering. Because by the way, when something's integrating your identity, you have to have a reason not to do it. And they are not doing it. So what's the assumption? There's a reason. Something's wrong. So he's laying there in bed trying to figure out what's wrong. What's different? You been there? What happened? She's lost that loving feeling. She didn't close her eyes anymore when we kiss her lips. There's no tenderness like before in her fingertips. Right? It's gone, gone, gone. That's exactly right. Whoever wrote that song was in that moment. What's happened? She have a boyfriend? Surely that's not. Well, then why does she feel this way about me anymore? Maybe she doesn't love me anymore. I should have done something different. Did I not call enough? Maybe I should have called more while I was gone. What's happened? What's going on here? So what's he feeling? Rejected? Distant? Doubt? Worry? Confusion? Unloved? The un of everything we said earlier? Unwanted? Unspecial? Which is confusing to him. Why? And what's funny is the wives are going, we're still talking about sex, right? Because she's happy he's home. She could not be happier. Them having sex at this point will not make her feel happier about him being home. She has him 100% in her heart. He's not sure what's wrong. So he frets about it. He may lay there awake for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, trying to figure out what's going on. At some point, he thinks, oh, this is a trick. If I go to sleep, she's going to zip out of that nightie and attack me. Busted. So so he wakes up the next day and feels what? Rejected. Confused. Doubted. Not home yet. Now, since he is a man with the emotional sophistication of a teacup, how does he communicate this? Confusion, embarrassment, rejection, uncertainty. How does he communicate it? Huh? Cranky. Jealous. Anger. Pouting. That's my favorite. Okay, so y'all appreciate this moment. I'd been married about 6 years, 7 years. My wife had rejected me, and I don't even remember the context at all. But being a therapist, I went in the other room and started journaling, was self-therapizing. And as I'm going through it, and at one point, I go back and start reading what I'm writing. And it sounds like, why does she want me? If it had been in that tone, like, I sounded like a six-year-old kid writing. I should have written in crayon with the little dotted lines in between. And it was like, I started laughing. This is 2 a.m. I start laughing out loud. And my wife, who thinks I've finally crossed over, she knows this is going to happen one day. She walks up and is like, are you okay? And I was like, am I pouting? And she goes, yes. I said, do I pout about anything else? She said, no, I've never seen you pout about anything but this. I'm like, wow. Now, I will tell you, part of it is I was introduced to pornography when I was 5. And when you're introduced to sexuality, which most of us were between 3 and 8, at least that's my experience as a therapist, anecdotally, between 3 and 8, something kind of hardwires, and there's something about us that reverts to that age when we face crisis in regards to sexuality. And so it's no wonder I wrote like a 6-year-old, because I think I'd reverted in my mind to a little bit of a 6-year-old. I was what neuropsychologists, I was in my back brain. I was in fight or flight or freeze mode. I didn't know how to think, and I got out of it. And when I went back and read it, it sounded like the rantings of a child. And this is actually part of when I started this process of figuring out what is going on here. Now, so with that in mind, he's cranky. He's irritable. He's confused in a bad mood. And it's not like he's going to say, hey, honey, could we sit down and have coffee? Today I'm feeling really confused. I'm off kilter. I felt so special that night when I came home that a few months ago and you seduced me. I don't even know why, but it was just an amazing. And what about sex? I'll tell you guys, I was really getting this, and I came home from a trip, and I was kind of flirting with my wife when I came home, and she said something like, "Oh, I figured you'd be wanting some later," and I said, "Wait, I no longer allow my clients to use impersonal pronouns for sex. It's not it. It's not some. It's not any." Certainly not a piece, anything like that. I said, you know what? I just drove from Arkansas to here. My guess is I could have had some anywhere I wanted to. What I was doing was trying to get home because I want you. And all of a sudden, what I learned later, some of the 3 or 4 years of hurt feelings and resentments that she'd been dealing with began to drain out of her. Because I don't want some. I want her. You guys will appreciate, when I teach to mops, I always use this example. And the women always laugh because this, guys, this is how most of them, this is their anxiety that they experience with us. They think, because they've been taught this, that we wake up like this, that we wake up in the morning and we go, I want to touch some breasts today. Where could I find some breasts? My wife has breasts. They don't understand that the reason that we touch them sexually, by the way, that was the third trigger for me starting to do this research, was all of the wives who would come in and say, I wish my husband would touch me more non-sexually. I do this exercise, 5 special things that your husband could do for you and 5 special things the wife could do for her husband. And what's showing up on the 5 list for women all the time was non-sexual touch, non-sexual touch. And the first time I heard that, I'm a good therapist, so I was like, okay, well, tell me more about that. But in my head, I was thinking, what is she talking about? Because, man, we don't divide out touch that way. That's not sexual touch and non-sexual touch. We don't think that way. We touch our sex partner as sexually as the situation allows. Because, why wouldn't we? I touch my wife as sexually as I can, given the circumstances, because I have to have a reason not to. So if it's just the 2 of us alone in the house, of course I'm touching her however I want to, sexually and non-sexually, because I don't have a reason not to. It's just as confusing to me that she's not doing that. Like, why are you always doing that? Why aren't you always doing that? The reason is because she doesn't have a reason to. She's not trying to seduce me, so why would she touch me like that? It makes sense to her. I don't touch her like that in front of the church, unless I really think I can get away with it. Why? Because I have a reason not to, right? I have a reason not to, so I don't. At home, when it's just 2 of us, I don't have a reason not to. So it's natural that I would. Now, here's what, so you'll know. I don't have a reason not to. Now that I understand how she interprets this, I have a reason to go out of my way to touch her non-sexually because her intuition is to read that as I want sex. Here's why. So it's divided out for her identity from her sexuality. So this couple, he's confused, he's irritable, he's pouting, he doesn't even know why. He's not going to sit down and have coffee and talk through his feelings, which might totally rescue this situation, but he doesn't know how to do that. Scares the bejesus out of him. The thought of doing that would scare him to death. My therapist, I'll say, men have two emotions, angry and not angry. That's our two emotions. I said, you're leaving out sleepy and hungry. Those are there too. Very often that's the case. We use anger as an anesthetic. We don't know how to feel what we feel, and so what we express is anger. You hit your head on the cabinet door. A rational, sane person would say, ow, I'm in pain. Would someone comfort me and give me a hug? That's rational sanity, because that's what you're feeling is pain, maybe even embarrassment. What you do is say, who let the freaking cabinet door open? That's insane. You have no reason to feel angry, but you express anger because the other emotions seem stupid and weak and you're not familiar with how to communicate them. But you know how to say, who let the stupid cabinet door open? So we're grumpy and pouty and then they have sex. And now he's fine. All those fears. Okay. All right. It was a fluke. No big deal. I don't understand why she didn't seduce me like last time. I'm sure there's some good reason. She still wants me. I'm okay. I feel like I'm the only guy in the world again. Everything's fine. The first time that happens, it's probably okay. So long as she doesn't ask somebody about it. If she asks an older married woman about it, it could be trouble. Because older married woman is going to say, well, what was he like before? He's real grumpy. And what changed? Well, we had sex. Well, there you go. That's men for you. See, if you don't integrate your identity into your sexuality, what did she just experience? He had me and was grumpy, irritable, unhappy. He has sex, and now he's fine. Of course, that's how you would interpret it if you divide out your identity from your sexuality. That's not at all how you interpret it if you integrate your identity and your sexuality. That's a totally different way of interpreting that experience. Earlier, she was happy and he was broken. Now he's fine and he thinks everything is fine. Do you see why it's natural for us to think engaging sexually fixes our problems? Because when it's integrated into your identity, it does. That's another one of the confusing things for women. You have a conflictual day all day. I've actually had women break down in tears when I've done that, when I've described what I'm about to tell you. You have a conflictual day all day. You've been on each other's nerves all day. It's been a bad day. You're angry with each other. And that night, you ask if she wants to mess around. And she looks at you like you're a freak with nine horns, right? Why? Do you now know why? You don't even like her, but you still want sex. That's all the evidence I need. It's what Hollywood's told me. It's what other married people have told me. It's what all the women know is true. All men want is sex, and there's all the evidence that you need. He's angry with me, but he still wants some. Now, if you interpret it through the lens of identity and sexuality being disintegrated, that makes sense. But if you look at that through the lens of, I actually usually make women do this. If it's a women's only group, I go, now, interpret it for me through the lens of somebody whose identity and sexuality are integrated. You know what? We've been on each other's nerves all day, and here's what I want you to know. You are still who I choose. You are still who I want. And I want you to know that in the most powerful way I know how to show it. No strings tied, just want you to know that you and me, naked and unashamed, is still what I think is what God has. I still choose you in the most powerful way I know how. And sometimes that kind of thing for women, they may be 10, 20, 30 years of marriage and have been interpreting that moment as a nightmare and suddenly going, I don't even know what to do with the emotions I'm now carrying, knowing I've been interpreting that wrong for decades. And it's hard for us to teach that to them and explain it to them and help them see it. to understand that's what we're really experiencing. What we really are experiencing is this powerful emotional connection that God intended. When you read the Bible, it is very clear that God intends sex to be the bond. He shall cleave to his wife, and they will be one flesh. One flesh, in every other passage, especially when Paul teaches it, is what? Naked and ashamed. Sexually connected. Paul warns not to connect your flesh to a prostitute. Don't become one with a prostitute. Becoming one is about engaging sexually, what God intended. This is supposed to be a powerful glue. He created sex is so powerful. Every culture that has let it run rampant so far is dead. We're next. We have released it into the wild. When I teach on sex, I teach my children. And by the way, if you've got to teach your sons about sex, I have that clearly written out on my website as well, how I've done that with my 15-year-old. I do 9, 10, and 11. I do three different trips, one at 9, one at 10, one at 11. The spiritual nature of sex, the way the biology of sex expresses the spiritual nature of sex, and the way the broken versions of sex combat or at war against the spiritual expression of sex. That's what we do. I describe it as fire. Is fire a good thing or a bad thing? Depends on what? Where it is. Right? If it's where it's supposed to be, it's life-giving. The human race would have been wiped out by a creature with better claws or better teeth a long time ago if we hadn't come up with fire. So somewhere along the way, we came up with fire, or God gave it to us, something happened, right? We got fire. And then we began to compete. It's still the thing that sets us apart from all the other animals. We do fire, they don't. What did we learn real quick about fire? You better put things that don't burn around it. I mean, it's amazing. In your home, you can't have your home without fire. Fireplace, water heater, heater in your house, stove, we need fire. What happens the minute that fire leaves one of those environments? It's destructive. It kills. Something that it gives life and we're utterly dependent on, we'll take it in an instant. That's sex. Something that we depend on and is wonderful. By the way, sex is not a need at the individual level. Let's get that out of our vocabulary. It's not a need. That's something that allows men to justify all types of ridiculous emotional manipulation. If you want your wife to engage with you freely, which is what was my thesis statement, is that what you, that is what you want, to freely choose you and be freely chosen by you, then there cannot be consequences for not doing it. There can't be emotional consequences for not doing it. So you've got to set her free to not engage sexually with you and learn how to inspire her. Because as we described, for women, it's a matter of bringing that together. It requires emotional energy to bring those together, to engage. Part of why Christian women always will say, oh, I love that we had sex, it's always great, is because they intuitively go into the sexual encounter expecting to find this. He didn't give a rip about me, he just wants sex. And then they have sex with us, and what they discover is this. They experience a feeling of that when they're with us, hopefully. And after that they go, no, that was great. The problem is it's so deeply in their intuition to divide them out that the very next day, it's back. Maybe 2 hours later, it's back. It doesn't take long for them to go, no, that was great. No, I know he loves me. I can tell he really wants me in the midst of that. And then the next day you talk about it. Does he want you or does he want sex? A lot of times I think he just wants sex. Right. It's deeply driven into their intuition. We've been taught it. The message, now that you know this, start watching for the messages. It's one thing when the world gives us this type of excrement as a message. I can tolerate that. They're lost. Incidentally, who are we being taught now about especially adult female sexuality? Part of what's driving us nuts is that we have these expectations have no role in marriage. That's my personal opinion. I've got a whole article about that. Kill them. I don't know why therapists have fallen in love with the concept of expectations. Let's talk about expectations because unspoken expectations are bad. My recommendation is all expectations are bad. Do you want to think it's a free gift or do you want it given because it's supposed to be given? If I expect my son to make straight A's, what do we celebrate? Nothing. Because straight A's is meets expectations. He'll celebrate that. What can he do to be exceptional? Nothing. He can meet expectations or he can fail to meet expectations. There's no exceptional. If I expect my wife to have sex with me and then she does, well, she meets my expectations. And I get an annual report. You get an annual review every year. How high a score is meets expectations. How do you feel about the meets expectations score your boss puts? What did I do wrong? What's funny is premarital counseling, a lot of times I'll do one or two sessions with couples and they'll have already seen other people and they'll have this spoken expectations, and I'll say, well, bring that with you, and then we'll get it. And I'll say, so let's talk about your expectations. Well, I expect him to serve me, and I expect him to... And they start listing all these things that are free gifts. I expect Christmas presents. I expect Valentine's presents. I expect presents on my birthday. I'll start saying that, and they'll go, no, well, that's... Oh, so you want these things free as gifts? Then let me give you a recommendation. Take that list of expectations and drive a knife through them and set them on fire. That's my opinion. I don't have time to go into that. I'm out of time. My prayer for you guys is that you'll be able to embrace this truth inside yourself and be okay with that. What I was going to tell you was one of the people who are setting our expectations out of line, a lot of TV shows, like the Desperate Housewives type TV shows, that show how what women are hyper-sexually obsessed people. Is that your experience? Is that what the women in your neighborhood do? When the pool boy comes by, do they all call each other and run over to the window and watch the pool boy? No. I don't know that any woman ever do that anywhere. Some women are starting to do that as an act. That's not intuitive for them at all. They fake that. Because they're supposed to, because the society is telling them that's who they're supposed to be. That's everything about the cover of the magazines at the grocery store. None of it reveals anything about females except what their anxieties are. All of those are there to make them feel like, I've got to buy this to make myself feel better. Why is there an article about 25 new different sexual things to do with your husband, do with your man? It's not going to be your husband. On a Cosmo magazine? Because women feel afraid they're going to lose their husbands because they're not sexual enough. It's not because she's obsessed with sex and wants to get better at it. It's because she's terrified of losing her husband. And maybe, and Cosmo will tell her, all he cares about is sex, so you get really good at that. Then you'll be great. And it doesn't work, by the way. But who's writing those? You know who's writing those TV shows now? Typically, gay men. The population who knows the least about female sexuality is who is training our country on female sexuality. And there's a certain typical, it is typical for gay men to see women as sexual predators. Because part of it is they see women as competition. And so there's a little bit of that is probably part of why they're doing that. They present women as sexual predators very often. So don't buy into it. It's junk. And it's lies. I tell most people now, if the media presents sex in a certain way, you can count on it being wrong. But every once in a while, they'll do one. You remember Pretty Woman, Richard Gere? What does he have? He gets a prostitute to stay in his hotel room so that he can just have easy sex, whatever he wants to, with no complications, right? By the end of the movie, the man is climbing up a fire escape to try to get this woman to be his wife. Why? Because men want a woman to freely choose them. Someone who wrote that had an inkling of this, a glimpse of this. That's what we really want. Allow that to be okay with you. Now, I would recommend somehow trying to have this conversation with your wife as well. If you're not sure how, listen to the talks first together and then have that talk. If this doesn't fit you, this is not universal. And those are the things that we think are universal about sex. Even things like men want sex more often than wives. It's only accurate about 70% of the time. But we get this circus freak feeling when you go and you're that guy who's like, gosh, my wife wants sex more often. This isn't about often of sex. This isn't about frequency. This is about what sex means. Yes, women whose identity and sexuality is more integrated, who grew up with a healthy attitude, with healthy dads and all that kind of stuff, turns out, their identity and their sexuality is more nearly aligned. Although still, I don't find many who it's like integrated. And yes, men who have jacked up versions of sexuality as they grow up, theirs may be a little more disconnected. But usually those can be brought back. So I want to pray over you guys for a powerful and vibrant sex life so that you can learn to serve your wives in such a way. Now that you understand how she interprets it, the key to this, to using this information, is trying to interpret her experience so that you understand what's really going on from her experience. so that you're looking at her, speaking to her, telling her you want her. Not it, not some, her. And if she's not interested, then find another way to experience her, and she'll learn that. Anyway, there's more, but that's all we've got time for. Father, thank you so much for these men. I pray that as your Son sets us free, we are free indeed. That when your truth sets us free, we are free. And your Son came to set us free. To set us free from the bonds of sin, from the philosophy of the world, from our own flesh, and from the lies of the enemy. God, it feels to me like the enemy has saturated, sometimes even the church, with stuff that was so clever to drive a wedge between us and our wives, because that broken relationship between us and our wives is a broken opportunity to have a massive impact in your kingdom. I look around me and I see so few testimonies that anyone will listen to in my country anymore. They want to dismiss me because I'm a Christian. But I have found they'll listen to me because I have a good marriage. So God, I pray that you will give us, God, marriages that glorify you, that everything we do, whether word or deed, is done in the name of your Son. I pray, Lord, that you would help us to be good neighbors. Even just that, even just what your Son taught us about being a good neighbor, that we would be a good neighbor to our wife. At home, in the car, in conflict, and in the bedroom. God, I pray you would teach us to be good neighbors who seek her best before our own, who think after not only our own interests, but the interests of others, who consider her more significant than ourselves, and who are willing to die for her like your Son died for your church, and suffer and face difficulties. And this is a tough one, God. We're not good at this stuff, so I pray that your Spirit would go ahead, prepare the way, help us to learn how to live in freedom in regards to the sexuality that you've given us. We ask this in your Son's name. Amen.